a passionate instigator and dynamic problem solver, Dr. Kevin Ross Emery, the host of the Dr. Kevin Radio Show, will be taking you outside the box, behind the curtain, and identifying the load of BS we are fed every day. And now, Dr. Kevin.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Dr. Kevin Show here on Om Times, where we're changing the world, wait for it, one Om at a time. And as always here on the Dr. Kevin Show, we try to bring you a variety of guests, opinions, insights, and as a live call-in show, we invite you to come join us in all of those things. The only thing we ask is that whatever your comments or questions are, that they're done respectfully. You don't have to agree with us. We just ask that you be respectful, and we'll be respectful for you. If you would like to be a part of tonight's conversation, you may do so by calling 202-570-7057. Again, that's 202-570-7057. And you can find about tonight's show Facebook.com/MyDrKevin. When you go to My Dr. Kevin, if you haven't, make sure you like the page. I'm a likable guy, even if I have to say so myself, and I'm not above doing it. So you can comment there. We do replay the show many times. So if you're not listening to it live, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on a Thursday night, then you can still go to the Facebook page, find tonight's posting. If you have a question or a comment for myself or tonight's guest, you can leave it there, and I will make sure that they get it. So, as always, in the Dr. Kevin Show, I'd like to start the conversation with my hot topic. And, you know, my hot topic is something that either gets me hot under the collar or warms the cockles of my heart. Sometimes it does both. Then I will introduce tonight's guest, allow them to comment or add their two cents, as we like to say, on the hot topic. And then we are going to dig in with tonight's guest and find out what makes him tick. But tonight's hot topic is about hypocrisy. We have gotten so used to it, we don't even pay attention to it anymore. Obviously, this latest sham of Supreme Court hearings speaks very loudly of the hypocrisy of what we said when we were negatively infected or going to be completely changes when it's you. And, you know, we kind of expect that from our government now. We know that if it only had two faces, we'd be lucky, but it has multiple personality disorder. Unfortunately, it's not a government that serves the people anymore. It hasn't served the people for a couple of decades now. It has been much, much too involved in serving itself. The question is, will we recognize the hypocrisy, or are we going to engage in it? Are we going to allow ourselves to be lulled into the us and them polarizing black hat, white hat, which screws over about 97% of America and keeps the other 3% well feathered in their nest above the fray and laughing their asses off behind closed doors at us. I don't care what party you are. Government is broken. Washington does not work for the people. And the only way to fix it is to go from the state level up. You've heard me speak more than once, and I'm going to say it again. I encourage everybody to check out the Anti-American Corruption Act. That is something that we can be doing at the state level to change Washington, because that's the only way we're going to do it. You are never going to convince the foxes in the hen house that they should vote themselves out as long as it's easy pickings. And right now, the biggest suckers are the U.S. American citizens who aren't from the state level standing up, making the changes that we can to force our government to actually function for the people for a change. So this latest hypocrisy is just another day in the life of Washington, D.C., and it will continue for as long as we tolerate it. We can change it not only with our national votes, but with our state votes. But we cannot change it if we do not vote. So I will now open up to our tonight's guest. I tried to make this as brief as possible, but I'm going to see if this man has any opinions that he'd like to share, first of all, on what I've just said. Knowing this man for a long time, I've never known him to have a shortage of opinions. So I'm looking forward to see what he has to say. Tonight's guest is George Husker Bulley. He is an actor, director, playwright, and novelist. He has over 30 years of presenting original theater and events throughout New England. He has continually created spectacles, not only of himself, but actually of shows. He's actually had shows that were spectacles. And now at his stage in life, he wears spectacles. But come to think of it, he always did. George sure. and I go back over 30 years. And I first met George when he was a journalist for the Portsmouth Herald. But he has been one of the singular, most moving, seriously, moving, changing, and evolving people behind the Seacoast theater community. Nobody has done more for it, done more with it, and challenged it more to step up to the plate. But that's not what we're talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about George's latest book. So stay tuned as we get to that. George, welcome.
Thanks, Kevin. How are you?
You know, I'm just a little bit of fabulous, but I'm working on fantastic. I'm trying to upgrade.
Oh, good. Good for you. Good luck with that.
So, George, any thoughts before we dive into the making the rest of the show all about you?
Oh, my God. Thoughts on hypocrisy. Let's see. I, unfortunately, agree with you for much of what you said. However, I'm not ready to throw the whole experiment into the ocean yet. I agree that there are many who work for the few, but the many who have the power and the votes don't utilize their power. So I like to put a mirror up to things like this. It's not, they're never going to give it to us. We have to take it. I'm not talking in any violent or any destructive manner. But we need to take back the power of our own government, and we can do that through voting. And, of course, I hear the argument, my vote doesn't count. Well, of course, as people become more polarized and jump on the right and left, those are the only people we're hearing from. I believe that the majority of the country is in the middle. You got the crazy lefties, you got the crazy righties, and then there's really everybody else who, I firmly believe, just want to live their lives. I don't think people want to stick their noses into other people's business. Government's been doing that, and I think if we took a step back from that attitude, particularly as Democrats, I think we'd have a lot more success. I think a lot more people would be less angry, and I think things would work better. Other than that, I have nothing to say.
That's the George that I know and love. Well, and that's one of the reasons why I'm really pushing through this whole election season, the idea that we actually have a lot of control we could choose to take at the state level to set right. up things that Congress will never do. And yes, it's very important to vote for the national elections, but I think people are completely blind to how much the state creates what can happen in federal elections because it's all decided at the state level.
And I agree. And I think there's so much cronyism going around. I think we should have term limits across the board, not only on the federal level, not only on Senate seats and congressional seats, but also for state senators as well. I think turnover keeps everybody fresh, and it keeps fresh eyes looking at perhaps older problems. Where the same eyes are looking at the same problems, we're not getting any new answers. And I think we need some new blood in order to do that.
I absolutely agree. We do need some new blood in order to do that. And in many cases, how can you ask the person who created the problem to fix it?
Exactly.
You know?
No, exactly.
So, yeah.
It's because no one is going to work against their own interests.
Nope.
Not.
So, anyways, enough about politics.
Thank you.
But
so Kevin, so which town hall are you watching tonight?
I'm watching RuPaul's Drag Race.
Well, there you go. That's, Lord knows, much more entertaining and probably more informative.
I stayed on top of pretty much where Biden is standing with things. I don't have the tolerance to listen to a lot of yelling, screaming, and lying. So I'm certainly not going to watch the Trump.
Right.
And so I can't be bothered. I really,
okay. Just curious.
Yep. I have already done my absentee ballot. It's already in.
Me too.
It's already been registered that it's been received. And I'm just, doing my little part to try to keep people moving forward and convincing them. If they're undecided, go listen to the debate. If you've already decided, if you think you know who you want, but there's any question, go listen to the other guy with open ears. That would be my recommendation.
Exactly. And if you don't want to watch either one, you can turn off the TV and curl up with a good book.
Speaking of which, I've been looking for a good book lately. I don't happen to have one in my hands, but I'm sure that could be rectified.
Yes, I can do something about that.
And you happen to write in a genre that I really love.
Oh.
So, which makes it, I actually have been collecting, and I've got some questions for you, and we are going to announce the book. And I am going to ask if you will go on either on break or after the show onto the Dr. Kevin page and in the comment section do a direct link that people can hit so that they can run, not walk, but run to their credit card and buy it off Amazon. Or for their
awesome.
Kids. I have, over the last few years, specifically been creating, grabbing people who are writing gay murder mysteries.
Okay.
And I don't know if yours falls into that category.
I was going to say, I wouldn't describe it that way, but it does. It could fit in that genre as well.
Well, and again, I want to know more. I don't know if you're familiar with the spring, summer, autumn, and winter. There were four murder mysteries that were set in the Portsmouth area, where the lead character was a gay man that moved up from New York that was an antique dealer.
Right.
I'm familiar
with them. Yes.
Yeah. But I don't know whether there are any gay characters in your book or not. That's an assumption that's an incorrect on my part. But I do love murder mysteries. But I'd like to see myself represented in the book that I read in a healthy, happy way.
Awesome. Sorry.
I thought you were going to say something else. I was waiting.
Huh? Oh, no, I'm just not sure how to step in. Let's put it this way. There are characters who are questioning.
Okay.
And there are
characters
who are experimenting, but that is a side story, not necessarily the story. Yeah. But obviously the book is called Walking Until Dawn. And
I was going to get there. Really, I was.
And it is a murder mystery. The unusual thing about the friendship in the book is that one of the two friends is a sleepwalker. And when he walks, his other friend tries to be around him to protect him, but that is not always the case. And when he's not around to protect him, bad things happen.
Yeah, well, I found that part of the concept very interesting, you know, because I did read through the stuff, and again, walking until dawn, and I do want to just make something clear, and then I got some questions for you about the book.
Okay.
I don't need, when I was speaking personally, I don't need the book to be a quote-unquote gay story. I just like it to have a diversity of characters that are well represented, but I still look for a good mystery or a good murder or a good, you know, I mean, it's still the genre. Mm-hmm. I just like to see a diversity of representation, healthy representation. So I just wanted to clarify that up. So,
okay.
First of all, for people who don't know you, you have written plays, correct?
Yes. Yes, I'm actually the most produced playwright in New England.
Yes. So you have gone from plays and shows and producers and actors, but this is your first novel.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of interesting because it does have its start as in the theater. Walking Until Dawn was a play that I presented at the Players Ring Theater about 16 years ago. And the story grew out of my own sleepwalking, which I was trying to find an answer to. And I started seeing someone, and the gentleman I was seeing suggested that I write about it. And out of that came Walking Until Dawn, which is a story about two boys who grow up at turn of the century South Carolina. One of the young men is the son of the plantation owner, and the other is the son of his head man. The two are inseparable until one evening, Maddie, who is the son of the head man, notices that the son of the owner is tied up and left and crying on the front stoop. And he goes to him and tries to help him to get him back up to bed. And Clara, who runs the house, jumps out and grabs his friend away. And he doesn't really understand what's going on. And a little time later, he ends up sleeping over at the house once the fathers go to town on a buying trip. And that's when he witnesses his friend sleepwalking for the first time. And he wasn't sure how to react, mainly because Maddie looked like he was having a conversation with someone who wasn't there. And the book explores who that conversation is with. And then he gets him back to bed and everything's fine. But usually in the morning, something horrible has happened.
Okay.
And the question is, who has perpetrated the murder? Is it the boy who's sleepwalking or the boy who's trying to keep him safe?
Okay, so hold on to that thought. Our music's coming in for our first break. We'll be right back with George Oscar Bowley and talking about his first novel, Walking Until Dawn.
Conscious media for conscious minds. Om Times. Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Dr. Kevin Show here on Om Time. Tonight we're talking to author George Hosker Bully, author of Walking Until Dawn, which is asking the question about who is responsible if a sleepwalker kills somebody. Now, I read it differently. Oh, first of all, remember, you can call in if you have any questions for myself or the author at 202-570-7057. That's 202-570-7057. 270-7057. Did I say that correct? Anyways,
yeah,
I must have two people. Did a sleepwalker, so the question, what I heard you say at the very end, because the music comes on, and when the music comes on, I have no, like, control over that. I just try to watch the time. So the question in the book, did I hear you correctly, is it the sleepwalker or the sleepwalker's friend? Is that what you said? Or did I hear that incorrectly?
Well, and that's really the question of the book. I mean, we have one young man trying to take care of another young man, and how much can you protect someone without becoming complicit yourself?
Interesting. So, like an accessory.
Well, an accessory to murder. Sure. I mean, the book follows Jimmy and Maddie from the ages of 8 right until both of them pass away as old men. So not only, unfortunately, does their mischief grow up with them, but after both of their fathers were discovered murdered, Jimmy Malcolm decided that it was time for him to leave. And he ran away from home, ran to another town, and tried to start a new life. He eventually landed in Charleston, South Carolina in 1901, and is enjoying the fruits of his labor, enjoying being a young man in a fast-growing city. Unfortunately, he gets word from home that there's trouble back at the farm and that they need him there once again. When he returns there, what he finds is a shell of his friend. Clara describes Maddie's existence there, that he is haunting his own house because he never sleeps anymore. He turns into sort of a vampire in terms of hours, where being up all evening and trying to sleep all day. But they were desperate to put him hopefully back on the right track. Unfortunately, when Jimmy returns to the farm to help him, things do not go as planned. And
so
more murder ensues.
So, actually, I was talking an accessory, like perhaps a scarf that matches. No, anyways.
And I hate to say it, that was the first thing I thought of, too.
I read your mind. You know how I am. So there's obviously some moral and ethical questions that go on. Now, I'm going to tell you, because just reading the write-up, because I haven't read the book, Right. Just reading the write-up, I was actually reading it as if somebody is sleepwalking and they murder somebody, are they responsible for the murder because they were not conscious? Like, is it really them? Like,
and that's the main question that the book asks.
Okay.
Are they really guilty? And it really depends on where you sit on the question. Just like, you know, being hypnotized or someone who drinks too much. I mean, you do things that you would presumably think something you would never do. However, if you're in another state and you do something that is completely opposite of who you really are, then did you really do it, or was it someone else? And that's one of the questions the book asks.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I didn't get the whole, from what I read, and it could have just been me because I had two things fast and furious these days because there's never enough hours in the day. But I was thinking, because I was very fascinated by that question, because with my background in spirituality and psychic phenomenon and stuff like that, there's always a question of, is somebody else inhabiting the body? Because
right.
In my world, that's a serious question. Is there somebody else inhabiting the body? And can you, if somebody killed somebody because they were drunk,
I would say, well, they're responsible because they got themselves drunk.
You kind of had.
But I found that such a fascinating premise. And knowing that in working with people for all these years, because, I've been doing this now full time for almost 31 years. I've dealt with people that were possessed, people that tried to kill people and they were possessed.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this is a very fascinating way to kind of introduce and look at all the different variables. And I guess one of the other questions is, are we sure that the person who is sleepwalking isn't actually the true person, and the awake person is just the mask?
And that's another question that it asks. Who really is the guilty party? And the book leaves that up in the air. Bodies are discovered. There is circumstantial evidence around. We know that Matty Gentry is a sleepwalker. We know that he has woken up with blood on his hands, but so has Jimmy. Now, did Jimmy get the blood on him as he was putting Matty back to bed? Or was Jimmy the actual killer? So throughout the book, we don't get an answer until the end. And that further blurs the line of responsibility. And it also begs the question, what is this guy either walking to or walking away from?
Yep. And then there's the whole fascinating aspect of if Maddie, the sleepwalker, is playing out, which I know that you looked at your own sleepwalking as the impetus to create the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much you actually researched some of the reasons why people sleepwalk, but having traumatic things happen to you as a young child at night in your bedroom can make you a sleepwalker. Like
you can't get away during the waking hours, so you're getting away during the sleeping hours.
Yeah, that psychological aspect.
And it might even be said that the retribution or the anger that you can express in your waking hours, you express them in your sleeping hours.
Yeah. So I'm curious, because now you've got me hooked. I have to read the book. But when you got to, I'm assuming you got to, at some point to the other end of your sleepwalking?
Yes.
Okay. So something that I'm going to share, because you don't know this, but I also was a sleepwalker.
Oh.
I had a few instances where I was a sleepwalker. It wasn't like repeatedly over a long period of time, but it was a half a dozen different times.
Mm-hmm.
Where people had to, like, in one case, they had to stop me from jumping out of a window. And I was no memory of it. Still to this day, I was definitely in a sleepwalk state.
So, yeah, and I have situations like that myself, which are luckily far behind me.
Yeah, yeah. So whether we try to kill ourselves or try to kill somebody else, there is definitely a connection of some part of us that is out of thinking, our psyche.
Mm-hmm. And I find it. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish what you're going to say. I can ask my question afterwards.
Oh, I find it interesting that Maddie internalizes all the anger that he has when he's awake, and he's a pretty amiable guy. When he's asleep, not so much. When he gets older, the line between when he's sleeping and when he's awake actually blurs. So when Jimmy has gone to the farm to help him, he figures he needs more help than he can offer him. He brings him back to the city and tries to deal with this on a psychological and a medical level. Unfortunately, you can bring the murderer out of the farm, but you can't take leave the horrors that he created there. They all travel with him. So even his attempt to start a new life, unfortunately, does not go that well.
No. And running away rarely does.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, it catches up with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask, was there a defining moment or a defining factor that brought your sleepwalking to a close?
No, it was, you know, the old personal growth. I mean, I was, when I started seeing someone, I saw someone who focused on sleepwalking, and he said, you're either one of two ways. You're either running away from something or running toward something. So through that process, I discovered what I was running away from and confronted that horror, if you will, and then I stopped having to run away. And it literally, I would say it happened overnight, because if you don't sleepwalk anymore, of course it's going to happen overnight, but all of a sudden, all of my instances, all of my situations where I wake up on my porch or wake up outside the house, all of those went away. So yeah, it's all about confronting. It's not necessarily about revenge. However, with Walking Until Dawn, it is about revenge.
A dish best served cold.
Oh, ice cold, which is hard to do in Charleston, South Carolina. But he manages.
So I'm curious, what was the connection with setting this down in Charleston at that time period? Was there any significance to that?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I've run a historical tour in Portsmouth over the last 17 years, which is historically accurate, but it's all about murder, scandals, and whorehouses. So I have, for the last 20 years, been a historian of places and periods and cities that, for whatever reason, attracted me. I've actually lived in Charleston when I was younger and loved the the architecture of it. And now we're talking, you know, in the 1960s. I'm not sure what's happened since, but I had a very, very specific romantic picture of Charleston, not only of the city itself and the old slave markets and the ports, but also 10 to 15 miles outside of the city where there were still plantations and where there were still farms, and the dichotomy of the two places I found very attractive. I've always considered myself kind of a small town boy as I grew up in Hampton, New Hampshire, but all my, or most of my adult life, I've lived in a city of some size or rather. So that particular place gave me two different locations and really two different worlds to put these two friends into.
Interesting. It's always interesting to find out, you know, like some of the choices the author makes along the way of, you know, why to do things and how things fall out.
And what's interesting in the transition was that when this was a play and performed on stage, it was Jimmy Malcolm who was the sleepwalker. And as the book has grown, the sleepwalking went to the character of Maddie. Right after I closed the play, once again, about 15, 16 years ago, I felt as if there were more story to tell. And so I sat down and wrote the first draft of the book. And then, as you know me, working 24/7 for the last 15, 16 years, I'd always wanted to get back to it to finish it and never had the opportunity until March 13th when the whole country shut down, which has been awful for everybody. But rather than sit staring at the wall, I figured, well, this will be the best time to revisit the book. And in that evolution, that last 6 or 7 months, the whole story has evolved.
Yes, the George I know and love. Always had to be a busy boy.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be right back with George Hoscabulli and talking about his new book, Walking Till Dawn, here on the Dr. Kevin Show.
The Real Conscious Connection, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound, sir?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Hello. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the last segment of the Dr. Kevin Show here on Om Time. I am here with actor, director, playwright, and novelist, George Hoscabulli. George's first novel, Walking Until Dawn, is now available on Amazon Kindle and paperback. Remember, we are now a live call-in show, and you're welcome to call in at 202-570-7057. Again, that's 202-570-7057. So, first of all, I want to see, because I'm going to start talking to you writer to writer, but I want to see if there's anything else you want to share about the book per se, because I want to make sure we get our listeners as engaged and hooked as I am.
Oh, well, awesome. The book has been reviewed a lot, and what I'm very happy to report, aside from the fact that the majority of the people who are reading it are once they get started, they're reading it within 2 or 3 days. I literally have gotten emails at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, damn you, I can't put it down. So I'm very happy to report that. But for me, aside from all the intrigue, it's really a book about a place and a friendship. I spend a lot of time talking about the architecture, about the topography of the area. And I also like examining the fact that you can have lifelong friends. I'm very lucky myself that I have 3 or 4 really good friends that I've had since I've been 5 years old. And I found it interesting when writing the two to see that sometimes friends have to let go of each other a little bit in order to find themselves again. Sometimes a relationship is so strong that it kind of constricts the growth. So it's good to spread your wings a little bit. And then when you come back, the love is still there and a lot of times stronger. And fortunately, in this situation, because of the type of story that it is, where people are getting hurt and situations are happening that are literally out of everyone's control, people have to, and this, I guess, comes back to the political discussion we started with, but people have to take action in order to ensure their happiness, not only for themselves, but for the greater good. I really see it, even though it's a murder mystery, I see it as a story of hope that you can work through anything, but sometimes the best way to deal with something is just to let it go.
Yep.
You know, sometimes things don't want to be fixed, or sometimes you don't have the skills to fix them, or sometimes you're not the person to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're emotionally connected. And the love that they feel for each other does step into intimacy before, which is something Jimmy wanted. He realized that he was not a man who loved women, but a man who loved Maddie. And when he thought Maddie was finally ready for their first intimate experience, he realized that Maddie was asleep.
Mm.
So who is he having this intimate experience with?
Oh, yep.
That's why when you said gay murder mystery, I balked at it because that's just a layer of the story.
Yep.
But it all comes back to, what are you responsible for?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, creating realistic, complicated, multi-layered people is both an art and a skill.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of America has gotten hooked on very two-dimensional characters through sitcoms and movies, and a lot
sure.
of times the nuances, you really have to pick up a good book to find that be well represented.
And sometimes things don't work out 100% perfectly. But that's still okay.
Yeah.
You know, the cookie cutter 100% happiness isn't around. It doesn't exist. I always like to think of, and I think of books this way a little bit too. A book is it's a city bus. It's not an Uber. No book can bring you exactly to where you live, but a bus can get you kind of close and can get you very close to what you're looking for, or get you close to home.
Yes, and a bus has a whole cast of very different characters. And an Uber has just you and the driver.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's much more interesting to have a bigger crowd.
So, as you and I both know,
that it's much more interesting to have a bigger crowd, George. Come on. We've never had a shortage of a bigger crowd in our lives, neither one of us.
No.
So now I'm interested in the experience because I'm somebody who I'll put a book down that I wrote only to have to pick it up 10 years later and breathe new life into it. And I did that recently myself. And actually just had a book published this year that took place in Portsmouth. So, but what did you find after a 16-year absence when you picked that book up? Did you fall back in love with it? Did you have mixed energy with it? What was that experience like? To find an old friend, so to speak.
Yeah, it actually wasn't what I expected it to be. When I started the process, I just sat down and read it. And as I read it, I was making notes on the pages. It seemed, it didn't seem fleshed out enough. It was funny. Even as a reader, I was writing questions that I had. There were assumptions made. Things didn't feel fleshed out. It felt like a Reader's Digest version of the story. And so I made a list of things that I wanted to flesh out. And as I started to write to fill scenes out, that experience kind of watered the seed for the next and the next and the next, and the story kept growing and growing and getting more involved. And then after I read it again, I thought, you know, but I'm not feeling a sense of place, which especially when you live down south for any amount of time, and of course we're both living up in the north now, but people in the South have a particular way of doing things. They have a particular cadence to their voice, and they have a particular way of living their lives. And I found writing that very comfortable. And I find much of the storytelling comfortable it makes you feel comfortable. It makes you feel warm, which is why when something askew or a ride goes on, which is why it's such a jolt. And all you want to do is try to find yourself back to that comfortable, warm place. So I found the experience to be totally invigorating.
Interesting.
I'd do it again in a heartbeat. Yeah, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. It was funny when the initial 300 pages that I read, I thought, boy, have I become a better writer in 20 years. You know, it's like going back and reading that paper you got an A on in high school, but reading it when you're 40. the luster has worn off over the years. So.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The experience and the time that I had putting this together was extremely rewarding, and I can't still read it and not cry a couple of times, laugh a couple of times, be horrified a couple of times. My plays up here are mostly comedies. This came from a period when I was writing mostly dramas. So it's a different voice for me, and people are really responding to it, and I couldn't be happier about it.
When I went back, because my book is called The Invitation, and it's the first in a 13-book series that I'm working on that's more alternative reality, slightly fantasy fiction, but it takes place in Portsmouth. The first book does, and then it travels.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went back to reinvigorate it and to move on into the series, because I had the second book 90% written, I actually had the experience that when I read it, I didn't read it as mine. It's like I was reading it and somebody else had written it because so much time had
mm-hmm.
passed. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like that? Did you ever almost feel like?
Oh yeah, no. And it was funny because I found myself after I started reading, just to enjoy it. And within 10 minutes, I had a pen in my hand and I'm making notes in the margins and crossing out things. So I immediately turned into an editor. I think because I had left it for so long that it did feel like a completely new piece. It still had my vernacular, so it felt like me, but I couldn't remember what happened in the next chapter until I had waded through it.
I know that feeling, and it's yeah. very almost disjointing in a little way.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to ask.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, when I'm rehearsing a new play, and you know I act in my shows as well, and you know, oh, it's time to memorize lines, and people always look at me. Well, you wrote it. Don't you know all the lines? I am always amused by that, because I believe that writers have stories to tell, and after you expunge it from yourself onto a page, it's no longer yours. It's the reader's, and therefore, after you put it out, it's no longer mine. I actually had to. Before meeting with you tonight, I wasn't sure which characters we had to talk about, but there's a main character whose name I couldn't remember.
Yeah. Well,
and I just published this a month ago and finished writing it 6 weeks ago. Spent the last 5 months writing it and couldn't remember the name, because I'm already on to something else. I'm doing an Underbelly book, which will be out next month. And it is a historical joke book, if you will. We presented history as if it were done on a vaudeville stage. That's what the Underbelly. Well, you know, history really doesn't have to be boring. And whenever anybody hears history or history tour, all they do is roll their eyes and people are looking for the exits. And after I had written some history for Strawberry Bank Living History Museum and for the city of Portsmouth, they both kicked back all the really saucy stories. So I took all the scandal that the town wouldn't put out and created a tour from it about murders and scandals and whorehouses and all the details of, you know, how many men this house could do in a night. And I did it live action with myself playing an accused spy and actress Sarah Shanahan playing an amalgamation of several actual hookers. And we told straight history, but we told it as if they were all written by Rodney Dangerfield. It's a lot of fun.
Well,
and that book is out next year, or pardon me, next month.
And, you know, at some point next year, because I'm booked out for the rest of this year. All my guest slots are filled. I'm now booking for next year. You'll have to come on and share some of those highlights and stories, because, you know, it's so different when you perform history. And of course, you know, my first venue was poetry. And I always said poetry was written to be read. So whenever this, whenever it comes to my poetry, it's like, I'm going to read it to you because that's how you're supposed to experience it. Right. And I've always found that history, when performed, has meaning. And reading it, it's harder to do that. So I love it.
Exactly.
I mean, you're right up my alley.
And when did, or how did history become so boring? When you think about it, the same nut jobs who are walking around the streets today are the same nut jobs that walked around the streets 200 years ago. They were crazy. They fell in love. They did stupid things. They got drunk and fell off bridges. You know, there were scandals. There was actually a hanging that was moved up because it interrupted with the sheriff's dinner time. And in that time frame, the governor pardoned her.
Okay, yeah. Well, those are the closing notes. George, you'll have to come back on the show and share some of your underbelly. George Hosker-Booley, Walking Until Dawn, available on Amazon and Kindle. And go to facebook.com/mydrkevin, find today's show, and you're going to see a direct link that George is going to put there in the comments to go over and get your copy. George, great talking to you. Thanks for being on.
Take care, Kevin.
Bye.